Well, thank you all for joining us for today's Philanthropy in Action teleconference with guest speaker Mary Poole, a cultural and regional studies faculty member at Prescott College. The title for today's call is the Maasai Community Partnership Project, and I would like to get our call started today by sharing a purposeful quote. And this quote comes from a Maasai elder: "Our sacred responsibility to the young and unborn generations of mankind is to jealously protect Mother Earth and all life on it." So thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And John A., I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Julie, very much. It indeed is a privilege for us to have Mary as our guest today, and I want to thank Richard Bockel for bringing to my attention the important work that Mary is spearheading. Mary, it is a tradition in our Philanthropy in Action calls that we ask the guest who is being featured if they would share a little bit of the professional and philanthropic journey that prepared you to do the work that you're doing today. And perhaps if you can weave into that just a little bit, I think we'll get into it a little bit deeper in the course of our conversation. But you might begin to share a little bit of how you were led to actually be doing some of the work you're doing today.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. I think that my work in Maasai land began in my teenage years, because my parents were involved in international development in the late 70s and early 80s. And so as a child, I lived in the U.S. while they worked in Egypt primarily, doing community development work. And then when I graduated from high school, I joined them. And so I have been working on questions about how to connect the more resourced world of Western countries with those of with the more under-resourced parts of the world. How to create equal collaborations, because that was the focus of their work. I went to Rutgers University for my PhD, and my work is in U.S. history with an emphasis on race relations in the U.S. and women's history. My my book is on the Social Security Act and race inequality and the origins of that act, and that stems from public policy work that I did prior to graduate school in the Washington State Senate. And all those threads connect in Maasai land, because a lot of the work that I'm doing there, again, looks at government assistance and private sector assistance, aid, and all the different strategies coming from different quarters to connect the resourced parts of the world with the under-resourced parts. So after I got my PhD, I found the job at Prescott College and have been here for 10 years teaching initially just U.S. history, but more and more development studies. Maidemay Oldapash is my partner in this work. He's Maasai. He's a community activist and leader for the entirety of his adult life. And I met him some 15 years ago when, after he came to the U.S. looking for partners, he was during a repressive regime in Kenya, left along with many Kenyans who were doing activism in Kenya at the time and unable to continue their work. And so he established an organization called the Maasai Environmental Resource Coalition, which is a community-based grassroots organization of Maasai people that includes an umbrella organization of a number of organizations, but that are all locally based, started by Maasai people in Maasai land. So he and I met each other and through my father, actually, through his work. And when I got the job at Prescott College, we were able to build an education program that has led to in many directions to water projects and to school projects, and also to our current land rights work.
Mary, if you don't mind, I don't know how many of the listeners today will be familiar with Prescott College. It is very, very unique. Would you maybe share just a minute or two about Prescott College, and then we'll come back to the primary topic of our call today?
Sure, I'd be happy to, because Prescott College is a wonderful community. It's a small liberal arts college that is located in Prescott, Arizona, and we have a resident undergraduate program, and then we have a limited residency program, a master's and a PhD program, and a total of about 1,000 students, so it's very small. And what makes us, I think what makes this school very special is its commitment to environmental justice and to social justice. So students tend to come here who are interested in weighing in on some of the challenges facing our global community. And we have very small classes, and so we do a lot of hands-on work with students, and students get involved with faculty in addressing challenges. So I felt like I won the lottery when I got this job. I still feel that way. It's a real genuine academic community that shares knowledge.
So I won't ask if Prescott College found you or if you found Prescott College. We'll leave that mystery to be shared at a later time. It is with that kind of introduction, I think it might be appropriate for us, Mary, to maybe lay a foundation for the work that you're doing today. And maybe do you want to hit that first talking point that you had suggested we start with?
Sure. Absolutely. Can you just give me a reminder of which the first one was?
I think the first talking point, just bear with me a second.
I think it may have had to do with the importance of
multiculture. It was the partnership with the gentleman that you were referencing before.
Right, Maydamay. Sure. Well, I can tell you that when Maydamay and I began to get to know each other, we realized that he began to share his vision with me of a partnership that would involve university students. He sees a lot of field studies programs in Maasai land, and you know, there's a range of quality, but what he sees a lot of that is disturbing to him is a distance between community members and students, and also other tourists that come to Maasai land to see the wildlife and that part of the world, which is incredibly beautiful and rich with wildlife. And sometimes people come also to learn about the indigenous cultures, but the structures of the tourism industry often create more misunderstanding than understanding, than mutual understanding, and some of that's inadvertent and some isn't. So he had a vision that an institution of higher education could actually partner with his community, and for the mutual benefit of both. And so our partnership together began on that ground of working to create a collaboration that had as its core a kind of a radical approach to equality, where we took the time to really understand the cultural differences that got in the way. We did a lot of work. We continue to do that work, but especially in the beginning and then especially with our students, we do a lot of work to understand what gets in the way of human beings collaborating together and learning from each other. And I think that I also touched on, maybe in that first point, the what is special about Maasai culture.
Well, one of the things that struck me as you were giving us some background for this call is that it seems like the Maasai people have exhibited incredible both cultural and environmental resilience in terms
right.
of the threats from the outside to try to draw them into a different cultural, to assimilate them into a more modern culture, and then kind of the environmental threats to their way of life. Do you want to talk a little bit about their incredible resilience and resistance to those trends?
Sure. Well, Maasai people are pastoral, and they practice transhumanism. So they have cattle and goats and sheep, and they have historically moved around the landscape to find grass and water at different times of the year. And so their environmentalism is a practice of moving on the landscape to accommodate the landscape and the wildlife and the seasons. And so they are as a culture deep environmentalists, and they have a long history of incredible resilience in a land that is subject to drought and that is in some places extremely marginal in the life that it can support. Some parts of Maasai land are just most of the year yellowed grass or dirt, you know, with some seasonal streams. And people have been able to eke out a living on very meager resources because of their strategies and because of their basic cultural understanding that to live on a landscape is to accommodate yourselves to that landscape. So, for example, where we live in Maasai land, there's an annual wildebeest migration that comes right through the villages that we're among, and it's a very famous migration that comes up from the Serengeti in Tanzania up into Maasai Mara. And wildebeest just come up with zebras, and they're everywhere, and they bring with them different diseases. And that's just, and especially around the time that they're breeding. The herders in the area of the villages where I live, when they see the first evidence of the migration, they get together and make a plan for where they're going to take their cattle, and they move their cattle out of the area so that the cattle won't catch the diseases from the wildebeest. So that's a different cultural response to an environmental issue than building a fence and keeping the wildebeest out or killing the wildebeest, you know? This is how this culture, this is sort of like the logic of this culture, is to think about solutions in that way. And sometimes people will be, they'll be away from home for 3-4 months.
And always motivated by this desire to allow others to survive as they survive. And that's very interesting. Now, from a political standpoint, as far as what their political and social agenda is and how they interface with the Kenyan government, what's going on from a political and social standpoint as far as interaction there goes?
Well, the Maasai community is one of the most marginal communities in Kenya, politically and economically. And one reason is it's of the, you know, roughly 42 ethnic communities in Kenya, the Maasai lost the most land when the British came. The British took a swath of land across the middle of Kenya that was the most forested land, the highlands. And a big chunk of that was Maasai land. So Maasai people were pushed onto their more marginal land. Unlike some other communities, they resisted to the best of their ability contact with the British and just withdrew into the new lands. Other communities didn't have that same choice. You know, they were turned into farm laborers. But so throughout the last 100 years, Maasai people have not been educated and have not been politically represented for the most part. When independence happened in 1963, the British control of Kenya's politics and economy was replaced in many ways, I think, from a perspective of the marginal communities, with Kenyans that were more assimilated. And a lot of the land, the bulk of the land, Maasai land, was not returned to the people. In fact, none of it was returned to the community. And so the So the community is deeply poor. This is a community of poor people, where a good school is one that has, desks, but maybe not floors. It's built out of old boards that people have pounded together, and children sit in an inch of dust. There aren't lunch programs, and there, maybe many children packed in a schoolroom, and there aren't clinics. There are many places where there's no clean water. And so there's a lot of disease, and there's starvation in times of drought. So it's a profoundly marginal community, and it's interesting because it is the community that's represented most to the world and through the tourism industry. Maasai warriors are shown dancing, and the beads are sold, and so the culture is very much associated with Kenya. The flag is the Maasai shield. Nairobi is a Maasai word, the capital city. But the community is very marginalized.
And just give us a perspective, if you could, roughly what percentage of the Kenyan population do the Maasai people comprise?
It's less than 1%.
So they really are a minority, a very small minority when it comes to having a voice.
They're a minority in themselves, and when added to the other marginal communities, especially those up north, the minority communities are a majority, numerically in Kenya. But there are many small communities. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So that, in essence, what you're saying is that if you took all of the distinct tribes, that's where you would find a majority. But each of these tribes is so marginalized, they really don't have much voice. And it's because of that, it seems, that they've turned to individuals like yourself and institutions like Prescott College to try to find resources and help to be able to survive and to prosper and to flourish. One of the things that you pointed out to us, Mary, in preparing for this conversation is how important the word collaboration is in terms of action taking place, and it seems like this really excites you and is what's driving the work that you're doing with the Maasai people. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The thing that is most exciting to me personally, probably the driving force behind my willingness every year to put on a field studies program and bring students to Kenya, my excitement about that work is that what I've experienced is that there is tremendous vision among local people in Maasai land about what needs to be done that is very different than the solutions that I would come up with coming in from the outside, even after all these years of experience that I have with this particular community. The solutions that I would think up are never come close to being as effective as the solutions that are thought up on the ground. And that makes sense. But I think from my perspective, being trained in the West, and because I am so highly educated and have had so much privilege and so much access to information and knowledge, I think that I assumed that solutions ought to come from the places where there's the most education and access to information. That's one place that logic would lead you. But instead, what I have found is the things that I have initiated are good, and they sometimes do good things on the ground. But the things that have been initiated by the community far exceed anything I could have thought up. And I'll give you an example. I'm a historian, and so I do historic reconstruction and archives, historical research and writing. But it never occurred to me to offer that skill to the Maasai community. say, I could do this for you. That came from the Maasai community, who approached Maitimei, actually, and said, you know, could your American partners help us understand how we lost this particular piece of land, which is the subject of the court case that we're currently involved with. It's called Mau Narok, and it's a 30,000-acre piece of the best land in Maasai land, the headwaters, that made their existence, their nomadic or semi-nomadic existence possible on the rest of the land. That piece of land was taken under colonialism and then was not returned after independence to the community. And they asked us to find out and tell them what the British sources and then the Kenyan sources say about how this land was taken. And factored into that request was a knowledge of many, many things that I could never access myself. I didn't know in the same way that they did that Kenya was on the verge of passing a new constitution, reinventing its whole judicial system, that the Maasai community considers land rights to be sacred work, and you know that this issue more than any other would pull the community together, and it has, you know. So I have learned in Maasai land, I came in thinking what people would want first is water and schools, and they do. And I'm involved in that work and give it my all, and it's really important. But it hasn't created a movement, a civil rights movement, the way that the land rights case has, that issue has. And that's because it came from the people that live in Maasai land that know their own situation and their own community. And so this work has been profoundly humbling to me, and it's challenged everything I thought I knew about what knowledge is and what you need to do hopeful work in the world, because I've seen just an abundance of brilliant thinking about solutions from a very different perspective than I'm used to coming from a Western perspective.
That is a wonderful glimpse of professional humility at its best. And Mary, if you wouldn't mind, I think it would be very helpful to us to understand how the students from Prescott College have assisted in this effort. And was that your idea to involve them, or did that idea come from the Maasai people as well?
Well, the community brought, Maitimei is very instrumental in all of this. He's the real bridge between our communities, he brought me into a position where I could also serve that purpose. So he's a teacher of students at Prescott College, and he teaches here in Prescott sometimes too. So when the community, he spends a lot of time traveling around listening to people and getting a sense of consensus that's emerging, and he would throw that question out all the time. What can our students do for you? And when the answer kept coming back, what about this Mau Narok land, you know, can you find out about that? He saw the potential in our students, and I think in a way that I initially didn't, because our students are highly educated people in Maasai land, our first-year students, you know. And it tends to be older students that go to Kenya and do this work, but already by their junior year, in the scope of the world, they're profoundly educated people. And they don't always experience themselves that way, you know, because in this culture, university can be a period of time where you're preparing for life, and so there's you're not always considered to be a full adult in the world acting. But in Kenya, you're looked at that way. So we would take our students to meetings with government people, and they would look to the students for, you know, what is your research finding? And I could see in the students, it was really a beautiful thing to see them kind of open their eyes to how they're seen in the world, and then to the depth of their own, what they already have to offer the world. So That's a long way of answering your question, but we took the students into the archives. Natame, you know, I mean, it was obvious to him that the students would do the research, and we took them into the archives. We photocopied stacks and stacks of documents and maps and took all those back to our center, and the students analyzed them. We divvied them up by type. And then, of course, I watched the process very carefully and taught them how to do this kind of research in the process. But they drafted the original report that we presented to the community. So this was our original vision, that if students could see their own power in the world, that it could be transformative to them as well. They could come home and to the U.S. and experience how educated they already are, you know, and how much they already have to offer.
And so that vision of how hopefully this experience would transform them and empower them really has come to fruition beautifully, it sounds like, through the work that you've been doing.
It seems to be working.
This Richard Bockel has made me aware of just how incredibly difficult and incredibly important this fight over the loss of lands and the reestablishment of title or right to this 30,000 acres is. Could you talk just a little bit, Mary, about the strategic importance of this 30,000 acres, and then maybe I think we have enough time to, if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit about where this legal odyssey lies and where it's going.
Sure. The land is located at the headwaters of the so at the southern end of the Mau Forest, if you know the region. But it's a big headwater that funds the Serengeti ecosystem, and so it's incredibly important. And so that this 30,000 acres was carved out, it's very much gerrymandered. Our research found that it was taken under colonialism illegally under British law in the colonial era. And so the importance of this land is that it is the place where the community can survive droughts, because they leave it fallow through wetter times. So the grasses grow there. It's swampy, you know. It's wet. It's rich with green, and the cows may go a couple hundred miles in another direction during the wetter times. So this place is reserved, then every 10 years or so, that when there was a big, deep drought, the entire community would descend on this place, and all the cattle would be watered and fed there in these elaborate queuing systems that would stretch out for miles in all directions, where every animal would be given just enough so that enough of them would survive the drought. And so it was a pretty brilliant way of using a resource. And these places also then became sacred because as the community gathered, this was the place that the big ceremonies would be held, and it was also the fatter times when everybody's together and the men aren't out herding. So, you know, the sacredness associated with these deep drought reserves comes from the fact that it's the place where the community comes together and celebrates life and rejuvenation. And so they're very important on multiple levels to the survival of the community and its culture. And that's why the British colonialists wanted that same land. It was the rich, wet land that made for wheat farms. So wheat and barley was grown there, and then that continued after independence. What's happening now, so through the course of the 20th century, the Maasai community has remembered and, you know, has fought for this land really for 100 years. But the research that our class did enabled the community to take it to court, because then there was documentation. And so the students gave a presentation to the community in the first time in 2008, and the people from the came in, walked in from this land, which is hours away, to the to presentation, and then moved back onto the land the next day, and so they, and then they took it to court in 2010, and right now, because Kenya is undergoing a radical judicial revolution. They've cleaned up their courts, and they passed a new constitution a year ago, and Kenya has now a human rights activist at the head of its courts, and so, you know, it's an incredible thing that this case, had been filed, and then it's like the judicial system around it changed. And now, so the case has received a lot of prominence. It's become referred to as an acid test, not just of land rights in Kenya, but also of the court system. And it's been in the press a tremendous amount, and it's being looked to by other indigenous communities in East Africa to see, you know, whether it's possible to recover land. So.
So is the battle today that's going on in terms of trying to regain title and vest title in the tribe itself, is the, in a sense, are those who are opposing this, are they people that took title through this British colonial period, or is
right.
it the government itself? They are, in a sense... outsiders then who have taken the land over?
Yeah, when independence happened, most of the European settlers left, and they sold the land back to the Kenyan government, which then most of this land was distributed to friends of Kenya's first president in like 5,000 acre or 10,000 acre chunks. So his personal physician got a big piece, his daughter got a big piece, his Minister for Internal Security. It was like that. It was just, and some of the land apparently isn't titled to these people and their families. Some of them are still living, the people who actually got the land in the, you know, after independence. In some cases, it's their families. But so it's individuals, and so Maasai people were moved off of the land for wheat and barley farms that have generated a tremendous amount of wealth for individual families who are not Maasai. And the community's interest is in getting the land back so that it can be communally owned. So the petition for the lawsuit is very much about representing the entire community, not any individuals.
And so now, Mary, let me just ask before we open this up for Q&A, is there anything else that you would like, any other points that you would like to make about your partnership and collaboration with the Maasai and the work that you've been doing to assist both in this battle over land and also to assist them in basically charting a course for how they're going to integrate and assert their rights legally and make sure that their voices are not lost, all the work that you're doing from a historical standpoint. Is there anything else that you want to share with us before we move to Q&A?
Maybe just that the challenge of this kind of work is that it is it's not as easy to understand as maybe it's very easy to see how a clinic serves a community or school, and it's easier for people from outside, you know, Maasai land to be able to see. Of course, that helps people in a good way. And so, but this kind of supporting a land rights case requires it requires funding, and it requires a community of people that take the time to really understand the how this reaches into the taproot of a lot of other issues, you know, and so Dick has been a tremendous friend to this project and to this particular case. And he's an example. So I guess the point that I want to make about collaboration is that this work is happening in Maasai land because of the commitment and of the Maasai community and their willingness to put their lives on the line and their safety on the line to win their land back. And it wouldn't be possible without the community of Americans that have been supporting it, and including and especially Dick. So it's an important thing to recognize about these kind of collaborations. They're you know, the deep partnership that exists between the Maasai community and Americans is I don't know, I'd say it's a sacred thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, I can feel the sacredness of that, and I think that was a wonderful point that you made about how difficult it is for us maybe to identify with the need. It's much easier for us to see the tangible benefit that flows from a medical clinic or from the school. But you've made a very compelling argument, I think, of the importance of this land rights issue. And I want to voice my own personal admiration for what you're doing and appreciate the courage and the financial commitment that individuals like Dick Bockel have made to support this.
Thank you.
And I want to, before we close, want to give you a chance to let people know if they are, those listening to the call, if they personally feel moved to support this from a financial perspective or in any other way, how they can get in touch with you. But at this point, before we get to that, why don't we see if there are some questions, and the way that we allow those who are participating live with us this afternoon to join this conversation is by pressing the number 1 on your touchtone phone, and Julie will alert us if somebody raises their hand virtually, and we'll allow them to join the conversation. And while we wait to see if we have someone who would like to either ask a question or offer affirming support for the work that you've been telling us about, Mary, let me ask you if you could to just look out over the next 12 to 24 months and tell us where your energies are going to be focused and how is Prescott College going to be marshaling the resources and energies of its students who are so engaged in this work.
Well, I think that our consensus right now is that the land rights case is the most important thing going on. So until that's resolved, that will be the focal point of my efforts. And certainly MEDEMAY is 24/7 on the land rights case in Kenya right now. We have a court date on December 15th, which is very exciting, and it's our second court date, and we're being heard in the Human Rights Court in Kenya. So these cases can take years to come to court. So we're seeing very clear evidence of what's happening with Kenyan courts and the fact that we're getting heard so quickly. And I think that if I look out over the next 2 years, I don't really see beyond the land rights case, but there is a possibility that it will be concluded before then, and in which case I think we will focus back again on developing the university in Maasai land. I will continue to take students in the summers for the field studies program that MEDEMAY and I co-teach. And we have been, since the land rights case is happening and we can't initiate another one until this one is resolved, the students have been contributing more research to this existing case. And so we'll continue to do that as well. We're, you know, at the service of our lawyers and community members, and also holding community presentations. all over Maasai land, which is something that's going on right now, actually. The community is educating itself and sharing information by holding meetings of thousands of people regularly. But when our students show up, they often give those presentations, which is greatly appreciated.
Speaks to how unfamiliar I am with the culture there, but is the I would assume that the primary language spoken by the tribe is a native tongue or dialect and not English. Is that true?
Right. The Maasai people speak a language that's called Ma, and then if they go to school, they learn Swahili, which is the national language, and then if they go to more school, then sometimes they become fluent in English. But it's pretty rare in Maasai land to find people who speak English.
So your students, as they're putting on these presentations throughout Maasai land, are there interpreters, or are your students becoming fluent in Swahili or in the native dialect?
We have interpreters for the presentations, but the students are amazing in the way that they pick up Ma. They pick it up much more easily than I do.
Well, great. Well, Julie, have we had any hands go up?
We do have one question from Dr. Chris Sidford. And Chris, your line is open.
Hey, Julie. Hey, John. Thanks very much. Mary, thanks very much for the presentation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And
great, thank you.
I'm always impressed with what people can do, this kind of effort, when they try and do it in their hometown, and then what it must take to try and do this on the other side of the globe is really impressive.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
There's a couple of organizations that I've worked with, and I didn't know if they would be helpful to you. One is, I don't know if you've worked with the Protomus Group.
No.
They are a group of attorneys. They're British attorneys, as a matter of fact. And they donate their legal efforts. They've been mostly in southern Africa, but they're extending up into other parts of the continent. And they're actually defending and representing people in the very same fashion that you are. And they do a lot of governance and a lot of work with marginalized communities. And it sounds almost identical. I don't know if them being from London would be on the other side of the fence, but they're a fascinating group. I met them at the Clinton Global Initiative, and they're a wonderful group. I'd be happy to make an introduction if you think
that
would
be wonderful. What's the name of the group, Protomus?
It's called Protomus, Protimos .org. I sent the website address to John and Julie, and
okay.
I'd be happy to pass it along, and I'll make an introduction, and we can talk after the discussion or set up another time. But they sounds like they're doing the exact same thing. And I think on their board of governors, there's a gentleman from Kenya. I don't know if that would be the International Advisory Board.
Okay.
So that may be more people in your backyard that might help you out with such a great cause. And the second group is a group called IMEC. It's the International Medical Equipment Collaborative. And they actually are a group in my home state of Massachusetts. And they collect medical equipment, and they send it out in a 40-foot container one a week. They basically donate all the medical supplies for the cost of shipping. And usually there's a shepherding organization and so on, and they can donate up to, $100,000 worth of equipment for the cost of shipping, and they've been doing it for about 10 years. They're very good at it. And you didn't mention medical, and I know clinic has an effect, but it might be worth having a look at it, or you and I can talk about it another time. I sent
that
website along to John and Julie as well, so those might be some interesting resources for you.
Oh, that's fantastic. Both of those sound like great leads. I'd love to know more.
Great,
Chris.
Great.
Thank you very, very much, Chris, for sharing those suggestions with Mary. Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mary, in addition to those ideas that Chris had, for those who are listening or who will be listening through the accessing of the recording of this call, I would assume that in addition to legal arms, one of the greatest needs that the land rights case is presenting right now is just that the sheer kind of financial consideration of trying to support the attorneys who are representing, actively representing the tribe in asserting these rights. Is there a fund that has been set up somehow that individuals or foundations can make contributions to assist in that fight?
Yes, there has, and that's a wonderful question, and you're absolutely right. This is all, moving forward on that kind of support. And, yes, so the Maasai Community Partnership Project has a website, which is maasaicpp.org. And that provides a way to donate money through PayPal. But through my email, money can be donated in other ways.
Would you mind giving your email address
no,
out?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's
why don't you go ahead and do that?
Great. MPOOLE@prescott.edu. And Prescott
so
is spelled.
M as in Mary.
Yeah.
Pool, POOLE, at prescott.edu.
Absolutely, yeah. And Prescott is spelled PRESCOTT.
Two T's.
Yeah.
Well, Mary, this has been a wonderful opportunity for us to become more aware of a critical issue. I think many of us have grown up admiring the Maasai people, and I want to express my admiration to a historian who has gotten involved in what might be one of the great legal battles of the 21st century in terms of setting some precedent that could have far-reaching significance in the African continent. So thank you very much. Is there anything that you'd like to say, summing up today?
Just that I truly bring greetings from the Maasai community, and I always say that because it's so true. And Maasai people tell me constantly, we can't come to you. You know, we can't afford a plane ticket. But we really value meeting people from outside. We can't believe that you care about us. We're so thrilled and excited and happy that people outside of Maasai land care about us and particularly care about this case. And so I try to express the heartfelt gratitude and greetings that come from Maasai land. So I'm bringing those to you, to everyone that's listening.
Well, thank you for that, and that was felt by all of us. Thank you again, Mary, for making time for this call today and for all the work you're doing. Thank you also, Dr. Sitford, for your insights and suggestions. And with that, Julie, I'll turn this back to you to talk about our upcoming calls.
Great. Thanks, Johnny, and thanks again, everyone, for joining us for today's call. Our next call is tomorrow, Tuesday, November 29th at noon Eastern with Barbara Culver, titled Most Wealthy Families Want from Their Advisors. And on Monday, December 5th at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Judith Colville will be joining us for a call titled The Power of Stories. So thanks again, everyone, and have a wonderful day.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much.